In a global industry where anything can happen, where mistakes cost much more than dollars, we bring you expertise from around the world to ensure that everyone goes home safe every day. The internationally acclaimed Oil & Gas HSE podcast starts now with your host, Russell Stewart.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening. Today, my guest on the show is James Agresti. James, did I say that right?
Pretty good for a Texan.
Well, I usually butcher them up like that. I often say, you know, when you listen to the intro to this show, there's a beautiful British makeover voice and all that sort of thing, and then, you know, here's the Oil and Gas HSE podcast with your host Russell Stewart, and then all of a sudden my Texas accent breaks in there. It definitely gives an international flavor, since I am proud to say we are heard in 130 something different countries. James, and you actually go by Jim, right?
Yes, sir.
Jim, you come from a foreign country. I can tell from your accent.
Yes, sir. I spent most of my life in New Jersey.
Okay. All right. And we're actually recording this, though, outside of Houston, Texas. So you now live here in Houston, Texas.
I moved here in 2020. And I have to say, I am so grateful to be in this state. I had a lot of good times and good friends in Jersey. But over the time, it just, the quality of life diminished, the friendliness diminished, the neighborliness diminished. And all of that is here and more. And the freedom diminished too. And the freedom, particularly when we came down here in 2020 with COVID lockdowns, the difference in freedom was palpable. It really was dramatic. In fact, I hadn't had a stranger shake my hand since COVID started, maybe 6 months before we moved here. And the very first person I met, my neighbor, put his hand out, said, "Pleased to meet you. Welcome to the neighborhood." And it's been like that ever since.
Well, that's great. Okay, so people are wondering, well, so who is this this Yankee down here in Texas? Jim, and the reason I wanted to have him on the podcast today, is the president and... actually, I think founder too, I think, right?
Co-founder.
Co-founder of a think tank. We're moving up in the world here on the HSE, OGGN HSE podcast. We got a real smart guy here. Jim is the co-founder and president of a think tank called Just Facts. Is that right?
You got that correct. I don't know about the thing about me being smart, but the Just Facts is correct.
Okay. Well, I think that we're going to see here during the course of this interview that that's going to be a fact too. So it's justfacts.com or .net or .dot what?
.com, .org, justfactsdaily.com, justfactsacademy.org.
Oh, wow. Okay. So if you get to either one of them, though, you can navigate through the rest of them, I guess. So justfacts.com.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. We'll put that in the show notes. So tell me about Just Facts. Tell me how you co-founded this thing.
Sure. So Just Facts is a research and educational institute dedicated to publishing facts about public policies and teaching research skills. It originally started in the late 1990s just as a website that my brother and I did as a hobby. And over time, it grew in readership. And one day, we got a link from the Taiwanese embassy in Manhattan to our website. And we said, well, why are we getting traffic from here? And what's this webpage about? And we went there, and we found that they had a listing of U.S.-based think tanks. And amidst some very prominent and storied names, mixed in with that was Just Facts. So the thought occurred to me, wow, these people think we have a think tank, and maybe I should start one, since people are already projecting that on us and think we're in that level of caliber.
So you and your brother are doing this research. You've got a engineering background, is that right?
Correct, mechanical engineering.
Okay, all right. So you think like an engineer, and so you guys are doing this research as a hobby, or?
Yeah, so I was doing the research. My brother was doing the web work or HTML work. And the reason, it was his idea. And the reason he came to the idea, he goes, you know, I like to talk politics and public policy with people, and everybody gives me their opinion. He said, except you. You give me facts. And that's why I want to do this with you.
and thereby Just Facts.
Yes, sir.
And you guys were publishing this on YouTube, or
there was no YouTube back then, if I'm correct. Yeah, there was none. So just the domain name justfacts.com. And quite frankly, a lot of it wasn't well documented. It was written like you think an engineer might write.
Okay.
Not so free flowing, you know, a little stilted and whatnot. But over time, we've amped up our game. And one of the things we've learned to do is have research protocols that really ensure we get to the facts. And this is a major problem today, particularly in public policy. You know, I come from a world, I designed jet engines right out of college, components and systems. And if those things don't work, the plane can fall out of the sky. In the world of public policy, people make false statements and enact harmful policies all the time. And the plane does fall out of the sky.
I was going to say, yes, it does.
It does.
That's the tragic, sad part.
But it's not so obvious. It's very easy for someone to enact a policy that causes runaway inflation and then say, it's those corporations over there. They're gouging you, or they're engaged in shrinkflation, when really the politicians are to blame.
Yep, that's exactly right. So you have several different areas of public policy that you specialize in?
We pretty much tackle every domestic issue. We don't do much on foreign affairs or national defense, but everything that's going on in our country, we delve into typically at some point. And that spans the gamut from economic issues to social issues. And I guess those are the two main divisions of domestic policy issues, but we hit a pretty broad range of topics.
Okay, so the reason I've got you on the show today, energy obviously is one big segment, right?
Yes, sir.
And you sent me some information when you and I met for the first time. We got to talking about various different things, and you sent me a, I guess you call them research papers, or
We call those, that the article I sent to you, it's not really an article, we call it core research. What we do is we take an topic, a big major topic, let's just say immigration or global warming or whatever it may be, gun control, and we try to accumulate all the verifiable facts we can find on them. We organize it by topic, subtopic, and sub-subtopic. And people can use it as a research guide if they're writing a paper or really want to understand an issue, to dig into it, jump where they want to be. Everything's cross-linked, and virtually everything is backed with credible primary sources, which you're not going to see on our website as an assertion backed up by a news article. Typically, when we're citing a news article, it's to show that the news article is wrong. So we're digging back to that raw data. We have the data sets available. People can access them. They can email us for Excel spreadsheets. We try to bring people face to face with the actual facts of the matter, not someone's interpretation of them.
So you and I got to talking about climate change. And so you sent me the article that I was talking about. It's on your website, so anybody can access it for free, right?
Correct. Free of charge.
And so I looked at it. And it had, was it over 600 references, footnotes?
Sounds about right. And quite frankly, that's a little low for some of our other issues. Our core research on energy is 1,000 plus citations. Again, to credible primary sources.
So we're talking about just the facts.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I wanted to have you on because I looked at what you sent me on the, and of course, climate change is you know, the big topic, you know, in the oil and gas industry and in the environmental aspect of it and the renewables and all this sort of thing. I just came a couple of weeks ago from methane mitigation conference, and I'm getting invited to them all the time. I just came from Sarah Week last week. That was all over the place. Let's talk about climate change.
Okay. So one of the most important principles in research is comprehensiveness, making sure you're getting a hold of all the data for the broadest possible time frame, and that you have all of the facts sitting in front of you. And what I see with the issue of climate change, even more so than other issues, is that studies, academics, scholars, newspapers, they don't do that. And when you bring in all of the facts, the picture often changes drastically. So let me give you an example.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's.
So one of the common things you'll hear in the realm of politics and even in academia is a phrase called zero emission vehicles. And that's another phrase meant to refer to electric cars.
Right.
All right. Here's the thing. That zero emission only applies to what comes out of the tailpipe. All the other emissions involved in the manufacturing of the vehicle and the production of the electricity to drive the vehicle and the disposal of the battery once it's done and the tire wear and the dust from brake dust wear, those are not counted in the idea of zero emission vehicles. So they're just focusing on one tiny part of that car and one part of the life cycle of the car. And even worse than that sometimes is there was an article in the New York Times this past week and one by a so-called fact checker called factcheck.org that says, well, we looked at it all. We looked at all the emissions and these things are greener than internal combustion vehicles, but they didn't. You know what they looked at?
What?
Carbon dioxide. They didn't look at any of the toxic pollutants, and there are numerous ones involved in the life cycle. And these life cycle emissions get pretty complex, but the most credible, most recent one out of the Journal of Cleaner Production actually shows that over the course of their lifetimes, electric vehicles will emit far more toxic pollutants than traditional cars.
And you have this actually... These are just the facts.
Well, like I said, this is a life cycle analysis. So there's always a little bit of uncertainty when it comes to them. And honest academics will say that. They'll say that in our paper. There'll always be something in the paper that says, well, these are the limitations. We couldn't really look at this. We couldn't nail this down perfectly. But as best as we can tell, the best data I've been able to find, that's what it shows. Now, that doesn't mean there's no benefits environmentally from electric vehicles. They do emit less carbon dioxide over their lifetime than traditional cars, as best as I can see. They're also, the location of the pollutants matters. So typically when you're producing these electric vehicles, a lot of the pollution is overseas. It's in poor third world countries where they're mining that lithium, and a lot of that pollution is created there. So when you bring one of these vehicles into an overpacked city like Los Angeles, it could reduce some of those toxic pollutants. But then there's also, these vehicles are much heavier than traditional vehicles. So it creates more road wear and tire wear and road dust. And these create tremendous pollution. You know, they're minute particles that lodge in people's lungs. There's a tremendous amount of science on them. And we have to look at the big picture, be comprehensive about it, instead of just focusing on one narrow thing and then having the media or a politician say, hey, these are zero emission vehicles. They're not.
Yeah, I've told this story more than once on the podcast. A couple of my favorite images, an electric vehicle, a Tesla, and I actually had the opportunity to interview one of the HSE managers at Tesla. And we had a very interesting conversation about that, and we agreed that there had to be a balance here. You know, for example, I told him about the picture I saw of a Tesla, and the license plate said no oil. Well, as you just mentioned, that also means no tires, and no other, all the plastic parts that make up the car are part of the the petrochemical industry.
And all the mining equipment that runs on oil.
Yeah, that's Well, as a matter of fact, now the person that was making the presentation, he said I got to admit this is a little bit of an anomaly, but he said it does illustrate a very important point. So I want to say it was over in Australia, but it's an electric car hooked up to a charging station. And then guess what's charging the charging station? A diesel generator. He said, but that really, he said, that really presents a true picture of what we're talking about here. And we need both. But I made a statement. I had to moderate a conference a couple of years ago. I believe it was a methane emissions conference. And the moderator got sick at the last minute, and we were there doing podcasts, so they asked me to moderate this actually for the whole day, but I had some certain panels I had to moderate, and I made the statement that the oil and gas industry was not the problem with the environment. The oil and gas industry was going to solve the problem of the environment, which was not met with real positive results from the people on the panel. I had actually never been surrounded by what I call true believers who have, in my opinion, drank the Kool-Aid. But that's kind of what we've done with climate change, right?
Yeah, it starts at a very, very young age. It starts with propaganda in the classrooms. It starts at Google. You know, there was a point when our core research on global warming was in the top 10 results of Google for global warming. Top 3 results for global warming facts. And then I think it was around 2014, the then CEO of Google said, "We have a fact problem when it comes to global warming. The internet is not providing people with enough facts. So we're going to fix this." And their way for fixing it was basically to say, "We're going to cherry pick the sources we deemed to be credible." And we were knocked down to like the bottom 400th, from top 10 to 400th, which nobody ever gets to if you're searching for global warming.
Well, sure, right.
So it is rampant. And the amount of illiteracy on this issue is beyond belief. And on many issues, we used to conduct an annual poll, and we hope to get back to doing it this year, that would check voters' policy knowledge of different issues. We'd ask them a question, something along the lines of, well, how's the air in the United States become generally more polluted or less polluted over the last several decades, or has it stayed about the same? And the answer by far, and this is EPA data, is it's become far less polluted. But a vast bulk of the public and voters in a scientific, nationally representative poll believe the polar opposite. And we can go issue through issue through issue, and it's rampant.
Wow. So climate change the oil and gas industry is going to, you know, cause us to all be dead by the year 2050 or 2030 if we don't do something about it. Comment on that, and how do we get just the facts out to people when you've got powerful entities like Google knocking you out of the game?
So I cannot predict the future, and I don't pretend to. I'm very careful about that, you know, because of the line of work I'm in. I'm always having people ask, who's going to win the presidency? What's going to happen here? I said, I have no idea. Well, why are people doing things? I'm like, do I look like Sigmund Freud to you? I'm a fat guy. I don't read people's minds. I present facts. So this is all I can tell you about this issue. We have 30 plus years of people making predictions about climate change and global warming. Very specific predictions from influential media outlets, recognized scholars and experts on that issue. And one of the things we...
And Al Gore.
Al Gore. I you know, his famous book, Earth and the Bounce, that's a 1992 book. All right? So we got 30 years of history, and he made numerous predictions in that book, and we can look at some of them. One of the ones that jumped out at me is he said, hey, you know, in the next couple of decades, you know, Bangladesh, which is a low-lying country, is going to be absolutely flooded. Their population is going to have to flee elsewhere. What kind of political dislocation is that going to happen? is that going to happen? I believe the population since then is up 40%.
And it's not underwater.
It's not underwater.
Miami was going to be underwater, wasn't it?
Well, even worse than that, he said shortly after that, 61% of Florida's population is going to have to leave. Now, again, we're here.
Now, this is in the book.
This is in the book.
That's what he said.
If you go to justfacts.com and click on global warming and look at the section and the a navigation menu on the right that says predictions and outcomes, you'll see the direct quote from the book, the context. I even have a video. I took off one of his presentations and embedded it. So you can see him saying this kind of stuff. But he said 61% are going to have to be evacuated from Florida. Now, here's the fact. The coastline population of Florida, I'm not even talking the whole state. I'm talking about the people who live on the coast. That population, since Al Gore made that prediction, is up 60%.
Instead of down 61%.
Yeah, and 61% for the whole state. I'm looking at the most vulnerable areas.
So how do they get away with this?
They get away with it because they have a media that doesn't hold them to account.
Accountability.
Very little. You know, how often do you see an ABC, CBS, NPR, New York Times, Washington Post story saying, here's all the predictions that have been made over the years, and here are the actual outcomes? I don't see it ever.
And so there's a guy here in Houston who was a very popular meteorologist. His name was Dr. Neil Frank. And I listened to a presentation he made at an API Houston chapter meeting, and this has been several years ago. It was well on the other side of COVID. And his comment was, and his presentation was, he went back and showed a lot of research. Climate always changes, right?
It does, but there's a question of how fast is it changing and by how much. And I've done some...
And about who... how much control... How much is... Don't you talk about that phrase man-made in that article?
Yeah, I do. And here's the truth of the matter. It is nearly impossible to pull out the man-made component. Because climate is such a complex system, all these attempts to model climate with supercomputers have failed. They cannot predict the future.
We can't predict 2 days in advance. You know, they told me last week, Thursday and Friday, it was going to rain like crazy, and, you know, I got nothing.
I remember one time in New Jersey, when I was living near Manhattan, right across the Hudson River there, I was listening to the local radio station saying, you know, we might get some snow today, and I'm at the window, and there's an inch of accumulation.
Yeah, that's how they can predict. They can tell you what really happened afterwards, right?
But in all fairness, that's weather. That's not climate.
Okay. All right.
It's a different science. It's a different way of looking at things. But it's very difficult to produce a computer model that mirrors reality. There's feedbacks. So here's the thing. Like, say, for instance, the Earth warms a little bit. One of the primary feedbacks is supposed to be, well, more the atmosphere will be able to hold more water because the air, you know, is warmer, and more will evaporate from the oceans. And that will have an amplifying effect. We really haven't seen that. They've been predicting this for 3 decades. It just hasn't turned out that way, because what happens is, well, some of that goes into clouds. And those clouds provide cloud cover that blocks some sunlight. So it's, again, there's a lot going on, and you can't go in a lab and model the climate of the Earth's ecosystem. You just can't do it. It's there's too much going on.
But if we decide to have net zero emissions by 2050, and we throw us all back into, you know, and get rid of our gas stoves and throw us all back into like a third world country or whatever, that's still not going to save the planet, right?
Yeah, and again, bear in mind net zero. You know what that means? Carbon dioxide out of an exhaust pipe or something that's directly emitting carbon dioxide.
Or out of a refining plant facility, yeah. Or something like that.
Coal-fired electricity plant, whatever it may be, that's not truly net zero. Thinking of an example here with, you know, some of the, Germany is a prime example. So Germany has some of the most aggressive green energy, and I put that in quotes, green policies on the planet. And there was an article back, I don't know, about a decade ago now, where they were talking about the cost of electricity and heating oil and natural gas in the country. And they've skyrocketed as a result of these policies. They're paying about three times more for electricity than we are in residences. So people are having a hard time keeping their homes warm in the winter. So you know what they're doing? They were going into forests and pillaging the trees, right? So that's not net zero emissions.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you know, it's dynamic. It's like economics. It's very hard to isolate a single factor. And you have human behavior. You have complex ecosystem interrelations. It's very difficult to figure out what's going to happen in a case like that.
So what we should do is we should try to keep the air and the water as clean as possible, but we don't need to reduce ourselves to third world countries, which probably cause more emissions anyway, like you said, because now for fuel, they're burning wood and they're burning cow dung.
Yeah, that's a big thing in third world countries where a lot of big corporations and big international bodies are saying, you know, we'll give you a loan to build a solar farm. We're not going to give you a loan to build a coal-fired power plant, period, or a natural gas one. So what ends up happening is they ultimately get less electricity for their money, and those people continue burning dung. And beyond the emissions from that, the inefficiency of that as opposed to, you know, a modern technology kind of burner, that creates tremendous pollutants that are in people's homes, right? If you're burning wood in your home to feed your family and cool, you know, heat your family the whole time, that creates a lot of emissions. And the whole objective is, hey, let's make life better for people. Let's make life better for the environment. And that's counterproductive.
I guess what I don't understand is why what should be some of the most brilliant people in the world who run, you know, the large energy corporations, I just don't understand why they've succumbed to all this or seem to have surrendered and why they don't present just the facts.
Yeah, I mean, again, I get into reading people's minds here, which I don't like to do. But there's a couple of important points here that are facts. One is, in 1989, a famous climatologist named Stephen Schneider, who was one of the founders of the International Panel on Climate Change and the co-founder of the journal Climactic Change, gave an interview to Discover magazine when he was talking about the, you know, the new threat of global warming. And he said, in order to fix this problem, we're going to have to get a lot of media coverage, and that sometimes means not being honest about how our weather reservations are, making, you know, attention-grabbing claims, hey, the world is falling apart. And then he said this, he goes, I didn't say honest in the original statement. He said, you know, we have to decide how much we're going to let them know, which is a lie of omission. But later in the statement, he said, ultimately, each of us is going to have to make the decision between being accurate and honest. I hope that means both. Not, hey, we're going to be accurate. It's, hey, we're in this double ethical bind. That's the phrase he used, where we want to stop global warming from killing us all, and also our duty to be honest with the public about what the science shows. So these people that are driving this agenda, at least one of the leaders of them, has said outright, we have to thread the needle here on whether or not we're going to be truthful with the public. And another thing is a quip that I often cite. It's from an MIT physicist by the name of Victor Weisskopf. And he was talking about experts. And he said, an expert is someone who knows more and more about less and less until finally he knows everything about nothing. And a lot of very smart people who are experts in their fields look at very narrow slices of information, like the pollution coming out of a tailpipe, right? Or in the case of COVID, you know, the number of infections of COVID-19, not the effect on people's lives of locking them away for the lockdowns. And a lot of those people have come out and said, I was too narrowly focused. I was looking at my field of expertise, and I didn't look at the way these lockdowns were going to impact people in the long term and bigger society. So that is a problem with people that are really narrowly focused on a single issue.
Okay, well, there you have it, folks. Really, you go to it's worth the price you paid for listening to this podcast today to know about this website, justfacts.com. And just to go in there and look at the climate change article that Jim referenced and his navigation bar about the predictions and outcomes, if you want some of the, you know, best ammunition you can get to talk to your friends who have, as I say, drank the Kool-Aid about all this climate change and zero net emissions by 2050 and all that sort of thing. Go to that website. Jim, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it. I'm really glad I had the opportunity to meet you. I'm glad to know about this website. We're going to talk some more about some other things in another podcast. And then I... folks, I can't sign off here until I tell you that not only will you find all this information, like I said, heavily footnoted and researched information on the website. Jim's also a published author, kind of talking a little bit about what he just talked about there about threading the needle between, you know, science and whether we're honest about it or not. So to me, that's science and morality, you know, or science and spiritual. And Jim's actually written a book on spiritual beliefs. It's called Rational Conclusions. And Jim, can they get that on Amazon, or where do you get a copy of the book?
It's available on Amazon.
Okay, Rational Conclusions by James D. Agresti, A-G-R-E-S-T-I. We'll put all that in the show notes. Jim, thanks again for coming on, and we'll talk again some other time. And for everybody out there, we'll talk to you next time. Thanks. Bye.
Tune in next week for another engaging episode of the Oil and Gas HSE Podcast, a production of the Oil and Gas Global Network. Learn more at oggn.com.